All right, so let's start by introducing you to our audience. Tim Gilpin, running for Congress. And my first question for anybody who runs for Congress is, are you insane?
Well, there are days I think I am. But you know, it's United States Congress, Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is not working right. There's too much chaos and dysfunction. So somebody has to step up. It was a little bit different than what we've been sending these last three decades.
So 435 members of Congress, if my memory serves, you know, what can one guy do?
Well, actually, what one person can do is work hard, make the relationships, do the committee work, and influence and impact and pass legislation that affects the rest of the country, all of us. You know, 435 members, not all 435, I know it might be hard to believe, are working as hard as they should.
What?
So there's got to be somebody who really is working and doing the homework and wants to make a difference.
All right. So, you know, I'm the guy who says, hey, elephant, right?
Sure.
And here's a Democrat running in the first district.
Sure.
When was the last time a Democrat won the first district? Do you know off the top of your head?
Yeah. The chairman of my campaign is James R. Jones. He was our last Democratic congressman. He left that office in 87. January of 87 is when his last term ended.
So 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. A little more than 30 years. So, and you know, my point is, not that, oh my gosh, we got to return a Democrat, right? There are some folks who think that, more power to them. But my point is, we've had three and a half decades of sending the same type person to Washington. And it's not working for the first district. And it's not working for Oklahoma. And heck, it's not working in Congress right now. We've got all these people in charge of Congress who aren't really trying to get much done. You know, it's like Washington's not solving any problems anymore. It's creating problems. I mean, who among us, even of the most partisan on either end of the stick, can say that Congress is doing what it's supposed to do, which is solve problems? So if we keep electing ideologues, I mean, that's people who are going to say, it's my way or the highway. You know, it has to be this way, a showboat. Then we're going to continue to see Congress do exactly what it's been doing the last 2 years, which is a lot of nothing except for noise and trouble. You know, my point is that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, we all deserve better representation in Washington. You know, I want to be about doing the work and finding the solutions to real problems.
You have a legal background.
Sure.
You were assistant attorney general.
That's right.
I always get my titles confused, but you're assistant attorney general for Oklahoma.
That's right. And at the end of the 80s.
And you've probably made a plea deal once or twice in your life where maybe you weren't happy and maybe they weren't happy. What I'm getting at is, when did the word compromise, when did making deals, when did that become a bad thing in politics?
Well, my job in the AG's office wasn't making deals. But beyond that, I know what you're talking about. I think it became a bad word, compromise, when we started electing people who were all one and not the other thing. When it was, my side is right 100% of the time. Right? And that's it. I'm going to score points. I'm going to invigorate my base of voters, and that's how I'm going to win, and that's how we're going to get to where we want to go. Well, it doesn't work. It's never worked in our history. You know, from day one of the revolution, there were good men and women who worked together, who got mad sometimes, but ended the day with a compromise or a solution that worked for America. What we're seeing right now, I mean, gosh, we've all thought Washington wasn't working right from time to time. I mean, every election people say it's the most important election.
Schroeder bums out.
Right. But this election, let's face it, it's true. And it's time that we elect people who want to make government work right, who wants to make government start to help being a part of the solution and not just another argument.
Where is the middle? I mean, where have they gone? Where are those people on Facebook going, can everybody just settle down for a second and let's find common ground? Where are those folks?
Well, you know, you won't always find it on Facebook, but sometimes you do. A lot of those people don't chime in as much as some of the others.
Right.
But we're all there, right? Somewhere we're all there. Where the middle is, maybe in politics, is when I look at the Trump administration and say I would like very much to work with them, is on infrastructure. Right? Donald Trump came into office saying, our roads, our bridges, our airports, our infrastructure are a mess. Now, I don't think we're a third world country by any stretch of the imagination, but it needs work. Mm-hmm. It needs a program to rebuild highways, rebuild our bridges, and our transportation hubs. So the trick is how we're going to pay for it, right? Therein lies the compromise. President Trump's proposal, which went nowhere in Congress, even the Republican Congress, laid the bill largely, if not entirely, at the state's doorstep. Now, we all don't have to go too far to know Oklahoma can't take care of its roads and bridges. So the money's not going to come from the state, the bulk of it. So therein lies the compromise. Let's agree something has to be done, right? Roads, our bridges, our airports, our transportation hubs are in trouble. Plus, it creates job. Plus, it's economic reinvestment. It's an injection of what we need. So let's then talk about how do we pay for it? How much will it cost? Where do we begin? There's the compromise.
So what issues would you not want to compromise with the Trump administration on? Yeah, I'm gonna go there. Because there's some pretty, there's some pretty strident objections, I think, among some Democrats about some of the stuff that's going on with this administration, and not just Democrats.
Sure. Oh, well, let's be frank. I think most issues can be looked at from both sides of the coin, and people of good nature and good faith can come to a resolution. What I can't do is be disrespectful and rude and turn people away from the table. I can't compromise on that. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm the nicest guy in the world, because I'm not. But I will say, if you want to reach from point A to point B, you don't call people names. You don't disrespect them. And you don't govern by tweets. All right, literally, we're all sitting here wondering, when's the next tweet going to come out? And foreign governments are doing the same thing. And large economic investors are doing the same thing too. The stock market. That chaos is not an economic policy. Rudeness and disrespect is not a domestic policy. And it's going to come, it is coming crashing down around our ears. So there's where I can't compromise. I cannot treat other people disrespectfully and say that's okay.
All right. So I want to go back for a second, because when I said something about as an assistant attorney general, you may have done plea deals, and you looked at me like I was crazy. So maybe I'm misunderstanding what your role was, or maybe I misunderstand the whole entire role of an attorney general. And that is entirely possible, by the way.
But you want me to explain?
Yeah.
All right. So think of it like this. Now, we're in state government at this point, not federal.
Right, right.
Federal has a similar system, though. You're probably thinking of a district attorney, which is the prosecutor.
The actual prosecutor, right.
Right, which is at the trial level. In our system here in Oklahoma, the state attorney general is in Oklahoma City. And
currently Mike Hunter.
Right. When I was there, it was Robert Henry. And underneath, they have an office full of assistant attorney generals who work in different divisions. My division was called, at the time, it's a different name now, the federal division. So my responsibilities were federal and state habeas corpus. And so my job was keeping criminals in jail and in prison who were trying to get out. Also, I did a lot of work for the Department of Corrections, because the Department of Corrections is always in trouble about something. So plea deals weren't a part of my responsibilities.
Gotcha.
Now, sometimes, this is probably more than you want to know, in the state attorney general's office, there is a grand jury division.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those, ladies and gentlemen, may be working on issues that are multi-county grand jury type. So they may be dealing with a more prosecutorial role, but that wasn't my division.
Gotcha. Okay, well, that makes sense. So talk to me a little bit about how that and what other experiences you've had in your career
lend themselves
to being a congressman from the 1st District.
Right. I served 6 years on the Oklahoma State Board of Education. Mm-hmm. So on the state level, we have a Board of Education. Each school district has a Board of Education. And on the state level, and that board is chaired by the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, State Superintendent of Education. That was 6 years. And I took that job very seriously. We went through the Great Recession during my term. And that is, at least at that time, the state board ran the State Department of Education, and we also dealt with state policy and implementing the laws that the legislature and the governor passed and signed into law. So I learned a lot about not only good education policy, but what was bad education policy. and more applicable to now and running for Congress, is where the money comes from for our schools and our classrooms. There's the state money, right? I mean, there's a variety of taxes and fees and things. There's local, there's state, but there's also federal dollars that Oklahoma's not getting. So I watched a lot of well-intentioned education professionals and the Oklahoma Department of Education attempting to get federal grants, federal program money to supplement what our classrooms get now from the state funds. And they were from time to time frustrated because try as they might, smart as they were, they did not have a United States representative helping them. And the truth is, every year or so, Congress passes a bill about education and education funding. It's your United States representative's job, J-O-B, to work on that and return some of those hard-earned tax dollars back home, in this case to our classrooms, to our school districts, and it hasn't been happening for years and years and years. Now, some of that money goes to career tech or VOTEC, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Expanding and working on the Pell Grant program for those students to be able to afford that education that's so important to our economy, our businesses, our entrepreneurial growth here in Oklahoma in the First District. There's also money for technology in the classroom. There's also programs and grants for children with special needs, children with higher needs, and food nutrition, right? Food insecurity is a huge issue in Oklahoma schools, right? 1 in 5 Oklahoma children is food insecure. They go to bed hungry, they wake up hungry, and you sure can't teach a child it much.
Who's sitting there thinking, what am I going to eat? What am I going to eat next?
And I haven't had much to eat so far. So those are really important dollars that you, my friend, and I and your listeners have already paid in taxes. But we don't have a United States representative working with the Oklahoma officials to return some of those dollars home for our schools, which are obviously in need. Now, that's job one, right? And that's what I mean about the importance of education from a United States representative, your congressman's perspective. Because you know what? Those dollars don't go away if we don't get our share.
Right, they go to somebody else.
They go to Texas. They go to Massachusetts.
They get spent.
They get spent. And their congressmen get pats on the back for getting extra dollars to their schools, whereas our United States representative, it has been decades since we have fought for all those dollars that were due.
And it wouldn't just be the First District, right? It would be like all five.
Sure,
but
sure.
None of them have really...
No. And that's the problem with electing pure ideologues to Congress, right? It's all or nothing. You know, we have had a congressman who has said to Career Tech and the schools, I don't believe in those funds. I don't believe in returning those dollars. I don't think those dollars should exist. So I'm not going to return them home. Now, the funds are there. You've already paid them. It's time they work for us.
So let me see if I got this straight. My tax dollars go to Washington. Some of my tax dollars are up for grabs for education, and congressmen who represent me in Washington are saying, nah, I don't think Russell should have paid that money, therefore I'm not going to ask for it back.
Right. Right. Or we don't believe in the fight to bring them home, which is difficult, and building the relationships to make, you know, the deals, the arrangements, the whatever, to bring those dollars home to Oklahoma.
Which is kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier, which is, you know, when did compromise become a bad word? When did it become a bad idea to say, okay, I'll give, you know, this far on this if you'll give me that much on that, and we see a way forward?
Right. So, again, Congress isn't doing much except creating problems, and that's because we've elected the same type of people over and over again who go to Congress to say, I'm right, you're wrong, and there is no in-between. And we're going to shut the system down instead of making the system work better. I'm going to tell you no all the time because you won't tell me yes all the time. And that's not what an American system of democracy is about.
You know, I think back to a book I read not too long ago about the writing of the Constitution, and how at the end of the Constitutional Convention, everybody, they voted it, they all looked around at each other, and nobody was happy.
Right.
They were all felt like they'd given up on something or quit before it was over, or they all felt that, like, nobody in that room was happy and said, oh, this is the perfect constitution for the world, right?
Right.
Okay, well, that's government.
That's right.
There is not going to be a deal where everybody's happy.
That's right. And that's how we were founded. I mean, there were people from the big states, the small states, the agriculture ones, the ones who were more in a different type of commerce at that time. And they argued it out. They fought it out. And then they went into a room and worked it out. And they came up with a constitution that, quite frankly, when they left the room and as they proceeded through the rest of their lives, they weren't sure it was going to work perfectly. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, we're the best form of government the world's ever known.
It's been pretty remarkable what's happened from that.
Even with our bumps and our ups and downs, yeah.
Right.
Right.
And all right, so I guess I have to ask, is this your first run for elected office?
Sure. I ran for state senate in 2004, but this is my first run for Congress.
Okay. And I believe your opponent, Mr. Hearn?
Right.
His first run for Congress.
I believe so, yes.
So either way, I guess, District 1 gets a newcomer to national politics, which is kind of the theme, right, with Mr. Trump coming. I'm the outsider. I'm the political outsider. And we're seeing the same kind of verbiage in our governor race.
Sure.
I'm not a career politician. I'm a businessman, right?
Right.
And I'm not sure if it's because it worked for Mr. Trump or if that's just what people want to hear these days. But, I mean, do you hit that theme of I'm a political outsider, I'm not a career politician?
Well, sure. I talk a lot about where my experience is and isn't. I talk about more about what I'd like to accomplish. I'm not as slick as some, to be honest with you. I'm not as smooth in the sense of having an easy line to deliver and all that. About the closest I come to that is saying Congress and Washington's in chaos and dysfunction, and it's time we put people into office who are a little bit different and who want to work together and come up with real solutions. As far as being an outsider, you know, I have not held elective office, but I think I've got a pretty good idea what we need and how to do it, and I'm willing to learn.
So tell me, besides education, clearly, getting some more, support for our educational system from our own federal tax dollars. What else do you want to push? What's your agenda?
Sure. I talk a lot about health care and a living wage. You know, on health care, in the world's richest, wealthiest, and powerful country, we have to find a way to make health care a right and not a privilege, because the old model of I've got mine, you get yours isn't working anymore, because we're all paying for it, aren't we, in higher insurance premiums. And in higher cost. So I support the Affordable Health Care Act. I think it was an imperfect but a good start, a good stab at the problem. So what's happening right now is the administration is taking it apart by regulation. And what that's done in the last 2 years is made our rates go up and the benefits go down. They're now trying to sell again, and we have such short memories, we don't remember what this was before, junk policies that will cost you very little, but will cover
almost
nothing.
They're also basically useless. Right.
They're also talking about doing away with the pre-existing condition exemption so that, once again, maybe insurance companies could exempt people who have pre-existing condition. Now, who among us who's lived a life doesn't have some kind of pre-existing condition? For me, it's asthma, which is, you know, something pretty darn important to me to get covered. So put the affordable health care back together, right? Work on it. Make it better. 20-plus million people more with health insurance is a good thing, not a bad thing. But we got to stop taking it apart piece by piece and driving the rest of us broke. Then let's look at Medicare. Can we do a Medicare for all? Can we make a Medicare option? Can we lower the age for eligibility to Medicare? You know, someone like me who's not at retirement age, if I took that option, I would pay more than someone who was at retirement age into that system until I reached retirement. That would possibly afford a lot better care. And you know what? I pay a pretty premium right now for an insurance policy that I'm not super happy with. So I'd be a lot happier with a better policy and paying into it. So that's an option that we have to look at. So there's healthcare. There's got to be a solution here. No one's going to be entirely happy. But it's one of those things now that if we just run on a platform of saying what we've got is horrible and I haven't got a good solution, then we're all going to end up in a worse place. A living wage. You know, the federal minimum wage right now is $7.25. No one can live on that. It hasn't been changed for decades. No one can live on $7.25 working full-time with overtime. So we're stuck with an economic underclass now. People who don't have access to the education because they can't afford it. People who don't have access to good jobs because they can't get the education because they can't afford it. And they can't make enough money to support themselves, let alone a family, or to save and get ahead. So that's why I talk about a federal minimum wage of $15 an hour. And that's something we have to look at. And we have to look into whether it's phased in, over what period of time, let's talk about it. But we have to get to a point where the person who's selling you your burger behind the counter is also able to pay their bills and also able to look at taking care of their kids while working full time.
You know, there's job numbers just came out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unemployment's way low. Practically, what was less than 4%.
I just read the statistics this morning. We've had 8 straight years of economic growth. We have more job creation about a year and a half ago per average month than we have now, but it's still growing, and that's good.
The problem is, and I'm gonna jump in for a second.
Sure.
I did a story not too long ago about Iron Gate, which is a place downtown that helps.
My church, yes, thank you.
Is that your church?
Yeah, Trinity Episcopal.
Guys,
yeah,
do a great job. So, and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but I was saying, well, you know, and I started talking about the homeless people. I said, wait a second. I want you to understand that a lot of these, you know, homeless people, they may be homeless, but they're working. They have jobs.
Right.
They have cars. They still can't afford a home.
Right.
And that's where it kind of clicked in my head of, okay, you know, homelessness and joblessness are two different issues.
Right. Yeah. Big issue, right? There are homeless people. Some of them are under dire circumstances that could happen to anyone. Some of them suffer from a mental illness or a mental chronic disease.
Which can also, by the way, happen to anyone.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And all of our families. And some of them are what we call the working poor. Mm-hmm. They're working, but they can't make enough to pay for an apartment or a home. Or if they do have one, it's temporary because they can't keep it up because they don't make enough. So we have, with this low, low, low federal minimum wage, created an economic underclass, and with a lack of a good education system and with lack of opportunities for higher paying jobs, we've stuck them there. Now, that there are some people who might say, well, they just need to do better. True, they do. They need to be ambitious. They need to be entrepreneurial. They need to be, you know, work towards bigger and better things. And a lot of them are, but they're stuck. So what we have to understand is they have to have enough to do the basics. And $15 an hour allows them to do the basics. Once they can do that, then they can buy things, save, pay for that apartment. And that's the working poor and the working class and the middle class are the economic engine of these United States.
So the counter, and I'll just go ahead and play devil's advocate.
Sure.
The counter argument to that is, well, the foundation of our economy is small business.
Sure.
You know, George's corner store over there ain't going to be able to keep more than two people on at $15 an hour. He's going to have to cut back his hours. His profits are going to go down. He's going to go out of business. And then not even those two people are going to have a job anymore. How do you respond to that?
Sure. Well, that's the fear every time we talk about a federal minimum wage. That's a fear every time we talk about a social safety net benefit of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all of it, as what's going to do to small businesses. Well, the truth is that we live in low inflationary times. Inflation's low. So if I have to pay 8 to 10 cents more for my Big Mac, I'm willing to do it. To make sure the person behind the counter can actually pay his mortgage or pay his rent and get by and be a good consumer. if I have to pay 18 cents more per Papa John's pizza, I'll do it. And that it's just going to increase the economy and create more jobs and more buying and more saving. So I just don't buy it. I understand the anxiety. I understand the fear. But the American economic model has always, until now, worked on the basis that it's constantly moving. It's constantly progressing. We are getting to the point to where people are able to reach a little bit further forward in their economic and their personal dreams. And until we appreciate that we're not doing that at this point today, we're going to end up with an economic underclass of people who can't get ahead.
All right. I have taken way more of your time than I meant to, but I always give folks carte blanche. I mean, what else would you like to have folks know about you before we wrap up?
Sure. I think Washington's not working. I think there's a lot of chaos and dysfunction and disrespect. That's not what makes a democracy run. That's what tears it down in the long run. So I'm trying to be about real solutions to real problems. I'm not an ideologue. I don't think the Democratic answer is necessarily the right one, neither is the Republican. I think we need to work for the right answer that helps the most people. If we continue, as we have for the last three or so decades, electing the same type people to Congress, then guess what? We're going to have to admit that we don't expect anything different, that there's not going to be much else that we can expect out of our federal government. So let's take a step back. Let's try and realize that Washington needs to work better, and it needs to start answering to problems as opposed to creating more problems. Let's look at electing someone a little bit different, and let's try to make the first district better. Let's try to make Oklahoma shine, and let's try to make America's problems a little less. And that's why I'm running for Congress, because I do remember better times, and it's time to be better again. It's time to elect people who aren't ideologues, but who are public servants. And that's why I'm running.
Great. Tim Gilpin, Democratic nominee for United States Congress, District 1. And congratulations on just even getting that far.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
Excellent.